Hi, everyone. I'm Rebecca Sugar, and this is the Sanity Interview. Every week, we speak with someone who is trying to bring a little sanity to his or her corner of the world. My co-host A.R. Hoffman's away this week, but I am joined by Sahaj Sharda, who's written an incredible book called The College Cartel. And I'm very excited to speak to you. We were just saying I have two 18-year-old children who applied to college last year. I know what this process is like. So very excited for this conversation. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to have this conversation with you.
And I should say that Sahaj is now currently a student at Columbia Law School here in New York. It may be one of the seats of insanity in terms of what's happening on college campuses. So you probably have a personal perspective that we want to get to in addition to what you've written about in the book. Mm-hmm. But let's start with this, Sahaj. Before we sort of dig into what a cartel is and what it means in the context of American universities, can you just speak about the problem that you're trying to solve for in this book? How does it manifest on campuses? And what are you seeing that you think needs to be redressed?
Yeah, so let me maybe share some of my personal experiences that led me to write about the book, and then also sort of give a maybe global perspective on what really the book is about. So I was an undergrad at Georgetown University when the Varsity Blues scandal sort of first erupted. And for those who are unfamiliar, the Varsity Blues scandal was essentially the scandal where like C to D list celebrities were paying athletic coaches on a wide variety of campuses, Yale, Georgetown, USC, to pretend like their kids are these sort of world-class athletes. And there was a classmate of mine whose parents went to jail during the scandal. What was really interesting about that specific moment, and you know, this is sort of the late 2010s, was that the way that this scandal was internalized on campus was completely contrary to the way it was internalized outside. And so on the outside, if you watch CNN or read the New York Times or something, they were saying, oh, how terrible, money's being used to corrupt admissions. But on the inside, at Georgetown at least, you know, sort of the student narrative was, oh, how terrible, her parents were being so cheap. They did this socially taboo thing. And it was just and basically what they would have preferred that her parents did was pay the proper donation to the development office in the millions, as opposed to $250K.
This is what the students were saying.
This is basically what the students were saying.
In other words, they all get the game and they understood what was happening.
Right. And I thought this was completely insane that was the way students were internalizing this. And so it made me really start to rethink, you know, what is it that a place like Georgetown really exists to do? What is its role? What is the product that even that they're selling students, if this is the way that we're internalizing what's happening?
Well, let me stop you. Yeah. You went there, and you wanted to go there, obviously. Yeah. What was the product you thought you were getting personally?
You know, like at 18, I don't think you think too deeply about, you know, what college is really going to meaningfully offer you. I don't think, you know, you're really thinking that far ahead. You're just excited in sort of this prestige race to get into these elite schools and have a good time and be away from your parents and party and so on and so forth.
Right.
And, you know, that was my conception of the university. And it was only after the scandal that I really, you know, paused and stopped to think about what am I really doing here? And, you know, sort of the global backdrop to all of this is college tuitions have been rising far faster than the rate of inflation for almost 40 years. And so the question I think we ought to be asking is, why is that the case? If you look at the U.S. economy over the last 20 years, the one place where you've consistently seen innovation and cheaper prices is on information products, information technology, they call it, right? Like the internet, ChatGPT, YouTube, Wikipedia. And so, you know, the question I had when the Varsity Blue scandal happened is, okay, we go to this place that's getting more expensive year after year after year. The culture's gotten so warped where everyone's so wealthy that they're sort of internalizing how admissions is supposed to work in this weird sort of class, you know, sort of like upper class way. So what really is the product here? And, you know, to me, you know, sort of the proof is in the pudding. The fact that the price is going up so much, even as the internet has made getting information, getting knowledge so much cheaper, means that there's a complete disconnect between the university and information or knowledge. It is no longer a place to just go and learn. You can do that yourself. And sort of the frame I would give, the historical frame I would give is, you know, in American history, we've had these great autodidacts, people who've taught themselves, people like, you know, Abraham Lincoln. They go in a barn, they borrow sort of law books, and they become one of the great lawyers, not just of their time, but of all time. That doesn't seem to be happening anymore. Even though, imagine what Lincoln would have been able to do with YouTube or ChatGPT or access to the internet or, you know, sort of even a library card. And the reason that's not happening is because college has become about something completely different. And we live in such a credentialed society that if you don't get that sort of entry level certification, you just can't enter into any of these professions. And so
that college has become about, you're saying, is the credential itself. That is the point. Yeah. Rather than the education. Did you feel, you know, our universities, the great ones, the elite ones, used to be vetting mechanisms for, you know, corporations and companies who would hire people afterwards and assume that they had already selected for the best and the brightest?
Yeah.
Do you think that's still the case, or do you think that's also changed?
So it both is and isn't. So here's what I'll say. So you're exactly right, right? Like, why do corporations care what degree you have on your resume? And the reason is because if I'm applying to a job, if you're applying to a job, a corporation doesn't know if we're lying or not, if we're, you know, just making stuff up, if we're overselling or overestimating or defrauding them even. And so they need some sort of third-party certification that I should actually take the time to interview this person. There are a lot of transaction costs when it comes to employment, especially, you know, before someone has a track record. So if you're 18, 19, 20, 21, you haven't really done anything that you can point to and say, well, no, I am actually good. I've done these things at my previous job. And so if you're trying to get that entry level role, you really do need some sort of third party verification. And the thing about third party verification is it only makes sense if everyone's on the same standard. If you and I are coming in with completely different credentials, then, you know, the employer is sort of in the same position. They don't really know who to prioritize in the interview process. And so there needs to be some sort of loose hierarchy, almost like a language, almost like trump cards. And, you know, you need to know that ace is higher than king is higher than queen. And that's sort of what elite universities are. That's what the college rankings are all about. It's why people, even alumni, you know, notoriously check the rankings to see how their school is doing, even though it really shouldn't matter once you're far off into your career. But the reason it does is because it's sort of this trump card. It's, you know, if I put in a resume, how much prestige do I have? How much credibility do I have?
I think you're giving President Trump a new idea now. I think he's going to start issuing little gold trump cards for universities, but keep going.
And so that's what the entire system is about, is the rankings sort of organize which credentials matter. And the credentials are really about getting you just your foot in the door into that first job. And it's completely divorced from any expectation that you actually learn something on campus or you know, you're edifying yourself or coming up with new ideas or innovating or doing anything on campus, really. I mean, essentially, you can party at most universities for 4 years and do perfectly fine in your career. Mm. And so, you know, there's a huge disconnect, like I'm saying, about what we think universities are about, or at least the myth-making that universities sort of promote, that there's centers of knowledge and dissemination of knowledge, and what they really are about.
So you're there, you see this sort of unfolding in front of you, you see almost the cynicism in your fellow students, and maybe you were developing some of your own, and you're starting to question what the purpose of the whole system is. And I think a lot of people are seeing the holes in the system in a lot of different ways, from everything from free speech to all the protests and the violence that's happening on campuses. There are a lot of reasons to start questioning the system. And of course, in the news every day, we see different responses to those concerns. You have a slightly different take, though, on the problem and how to solve it.
Yep.
Your book, The College Cartel, suggests that this isn't something that just unfolded sort of organically. This was a collusion of sorts between the elite universities, and they have created this problem. And all the problems that we see that manifest on campuses are sort of downstream of the essential problem, which is?
Right. So everything I've said in this interview up to this point is just sort of explaining what the product is. What is it that people are purchasing? But I haven't really spoken about how that product is supplied. Mm-hmm. And I think that really is the critical question that gets too little coverage in the mainstream media, which is to say the universities, I mean, if you look at Harvard or Yale and you look at their enrollments over the last 20 years, it's essentially been flat. And this is even though the number of applications have exponentially increased. You have now talented people from all over the world, from China, from India, from Europe. Everyone wants to get into the elite American universities, you know, the upper class of all of these societies. And because of globalization, now more and more people are coming. And so even if, you know, there's a sort of economic study where even if the universities were just keeping standards the same as 1990, you would expect them to triple enrollment by now. So it would be the exact same caliber or quality of student as someone who graduated in 1990 or got in 1990. You would have three times the output. Instead, you've seen literally flat output. And to me, that's a really important question, because what that delta explains is if demand explodes in that way and supply does not, you would naturally expect price to, you know, start to rise and rise and rise, which is exactly what you've seen at the universities. And so that was sort of the originating question of the college cartel, which is how have universities managed to do this? Why aren't they expanding output? And how is it that in unison, they're not expanding output? You know, in a competitive market, you'd expect if Harvard doesn't want to expand, Yale would, to steal away those marginal students. That's not happening.
And the they're effectively, yeah. I think you call them sort of like a luxury brand. They're maintaining the same sort of scarcity of supply in order to maintain their status as a luxury brand. They're doing it on purpose.
I would even take it a step further. You know, luxury brands sort of restrict supply to be very exclusive, but they're not like Gucci isn't colluding with LVMH to say we're both going to only offer so many bags. There is still some level of competition. In the college context, it's even worse. So not only are they luxury brands, but they're also colluding with each other to keep output industry-wide even lower than it otherwise would be. So it's almost like LVMH on steroids. It's like LVMH meets OPEC. It's the worst of both of those markets.
Okay, so let's explain you lay out some different ways in which this collusion actually happens. Yeah. And one of the main points you make is to do with the ranking systems and U.S. News and World Report. So talk about how that reflects this kind of collusion.
Yeah, so like I said before, the rankings really matter because they organize, you know, sort of which signals or which credentials are more valuable than others in the minds of employers. And so every school sort of needs to play ball with the rankings. And now what the elite colleges have done, which is very clever, is they've sort of worked hand in hand through indirect pressure and quite frankly, sometimes probably even direct pressure on U.S. News and World Report to structure the rankings in a way that they're output restricting. What do I mean by this? The essential logic of the U.S. News and World Report rankings is spend as much money as possible on as few students as possible, and you will climb in rank. So the two logics of that sort of formulation is make education much more expensive. So this is exactly what we've seen. And educate as few people as possible, which is exactly what we've seen. And in unison, when everyone's doing that in the industry in order to maintain or climb in rank, which is what the competitive dynamic has now revolved around, there is no actual competition. And what you end up seeing is more or less the same schools sort of maintain rank, and there's just less and less output at higher and higher prices. And it's getting so unsustainable. I mean, the debt problem is out of control. You know, sort of the derangement of some of these campuses, I think you can trace directly back to this, which is that you have wealthier and wealthier people completely disconnected from the real world on these campuses. And they need to sort of, borrow struggles to feel some sense of meaning in their lives.
And that's a very good point. I think that's probably true. And it's also true that this ranking system favors a bloated administration in all of these schools, bloated faculties, and fewer students, so that the ratio is favorable. You know, it looks like, oh, wow, this, you know, freshman's going to get 10 administrators and faculty members to his one, you know, to his one student, and that's a great ratio in his favor. But actually, what are those people really doing except soaking up more money and creating departments and departments and departments that may not be of use to the student?
So that's not only is that completely right, I would actually go even a step further. You know, the logic of the rankings has metastasized into the institutional logic of these universities. And so if I'm an administrator at a place like Columbia or Yale, where and at Yale specifically, I think there are more administrators than students at this point, which is an outrageous thing to say. But if I'm an administrator at Yale, you know, sort of the best thing possible for me is to hire two people underneath me, because that gives me people to manage and therefore allows me to make the argument that I deserve a raise. And over time, the, you know, sort of bureaucracy starts to metastasize. The issue you have then is if you have all these people in fake jobs, they need a reason not to get fired or to justify why they exist on campus. And so the narrative that they've chosen for themselves is that campuses have become very dangerous and that they're there for student safety. And they then come up with all sorts of fake boogeymen that they're supposedly protecting students from. And over time, this completely deranges the culture on campuses. Campuses where people used to openly and freely discuss ideas now become much more politically correct because you have this entire administrative class trying to push that kind of political correctness because they need to justify why they exist. And all of this, I think, is downstream market structure and economic incentives.
So this is the collusion piece of this is that you're saying that the universities are sort of working with U.S. News and World Report to set the parameters and the metrics around the ranking system so that this is the result.
And again, I don't want to make any specific claims about, you know, they're directly colluding as in there was a phone call at this date or something like this. Although there undoubtedly is that type of relationship when the owner of U.S. News and World Report is on the boards of many of these elite universities, when elite universities so interface so closely with U.S. News and World Report. But I don't want to make any of those claims. I guess my point is, you know, the market structure, either directly or indirectly, has sort of emerged as this hub and spoke cartel, where you have U.S. News and World Report that sort of does the bidding of the elite universities, and in exchange, you know, it sort of gets to borrow some of their credibility in the present. And what it offers to the elite university is to maintain their rank in the future. And so there's sort of this tit for tat where the ranking is getting credibility in today and the universities are getting dominance tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And that structure is very unhealthy for society because it's reducing output. So now we have way more zero-sum fights over who gets the limited number of seats on these elite campuses. You have much higher prices, which is really bad for people who come from lower income households. And you have this, you know, sort of institutional problem where you get more and more bloated bureaucracy because they have so much monopoly rent, which they have to spend on something because it's a nonprofit. It's not like they can, you know, do a share buyback or dividends. And so over time, you end up with a more and more deranged product because the cartel is so restricting and suffocating.
Okay, and you also talk in the book about the sort of cartel aspect of having so many private equity fund managers and hedge fund managers on the boards of these academic institutions, and then also the endowment funds maybe investing in some of their funds. So talk a little bit about that and why you see that as a problem.
Yeah, so, you know, the question I had was, okay, you see, I mean, it's so obvious when you're on one of these universities, there's all this administrative bloat. These people aren't really doing anything. Why hasn't, you know, someone come in and just fired everyone, sort of like Elon Musk did at Twitter or you know, maybe some of the things that Doge is doing now? And I guess the real answer is because if you look at the board of trustees and their composition, it oftentimes is hedge fund managers or private equity managers or big law partners, et cetera, people who essentially deal in the business of raising and deploying capital. Now, the university endowments, especially at the most elite schools, are just big pools of money for those types of people to go out and deploy. And so if you think about you know, the university as a nonprofit, that's not exactly right. What's actually happening is that there are two classes of people who are making a profit. The first is the bloated bureaucracy that's in these sort of, David Graeber would call bullshit jobs. And then the second class of people is sort of the hedge fund and private equity lords who get sort of investments or have the endowments, BLPs in their funds, and then they end up making money off of that 2-in-20 model.
So what's your solution to that? What would be the answer? You can't exclude people from boards. We can't say to people who are alumni of many of these institutions mm-hmm. that they can't come back and serve the institution. So how do you solve for that?
Yeah, I think the governance problem would sort of solve itself if there was more competition, right? So if there's more competition, then, you know, sort of the individual managers of any organization have less and less discretion. But when there's very little competition, they have almost unlimited discretion. And then you really depend on them to manage the institution well. But I think one thing we know about cartelized or monopolized markets is that the product and the, you know, organizations in them get worse and worse over time. So if you think about like Xerox or Kodak or any of these sort of really famous American institutions, over time, they stopped innovating, the products got worse. Eventually, you had worse and worse management, and then they just collapsed. They fell off a cliff. And that's sort of what's happening to elite American institutions today, and especially the universities. So my fix would be that we have to break up this hub and spoke cartel between U.S. News and World Report and the universities. And one way to do that is something that Trump tried in his first administration, which I actually give him great credit for, which is an endowment tax. And the way he structured the endowment tax specifically was if you have a certain endowment over, you know, your student body population, so if it's like $500,000 per student or more, then you have to pay a tax on capital on your capital gains. The problem with the first Trump administration proposal was the tax wasn't high enough. If the tax had been much higher, you know, even the corporate income tax, like 20% or something more than that, instead of a penny out of a dollar of gain, what you would see is that the schools would have to expand output. As they expanded output to not pay the endowment taxes, there'd be more competition on price. So there's more competition on price, sort of their revenues may even go down. And what that then means is that they naturally have to start firing some of the bureaucrats. They naturally have to revert to better teaching to retain students or things of this nature. And I think that would be a much healthier system that I think we should all look forward to.
And what do you say to people who insist that there has to be a certain elitism about this system in order to produce, as we said earlier, the kind of vetted class of the best and the brightest who then companies can rely on to run the world? I mean, what do you, if you keep expanding the class sizes of these schools, you don't get, you know, a vetted group of the best and the brightest. So how do you fit that into your
So I think everything that you just said there is completely right. But it's not a binary between we let in no one and we let in an infinite number of people, right? So I think, you know, even if you kept standards the same as 1990, there'd be a 3x output. I think it's, you know, completely plausible that Harvard, instead of having a low single digit acceptance rate of 2 to 3%, sometimes 4%, they could easily accept 15% of students and still maintain quite a high level of exclusivity.
But they'd all the schools would have to collude to do that together. No one school would Harvard go to 15% if Vanderbilt is still at 5%?
Well, if there was some sort of structural pressure, so if you brought in the endowment tax or you changed the U.S. News and World Report ranking to incentivize greater output, then they would all do so in unison without necessarily needing to collude with each other. And I think that's sort of the point is, you know, this is sort of an artificial scarcity that we've created much beyond anything needed for the market to clear or function in terms of making sure that we have the best and brightest coming out of these institutions. And in fact, I think in many cases, we don't let the best and brightest go to these institutions, which is a great detriment both to the nation and the institutions themselves.
We spoke last week, actually, to Dr. Pano Canales, who started UATX in Houston. Yep. And his solution and his group's solution is to simply build competing institutions that have a different ethos, a different outlook.
Yep.
What do you make of that model? Would you apply that to the U.S. World News and World Report rankings? Should we just build a different ranking system and a different publication? If you can't fix the broken system, do you just build new systems?
So look, I think that works in a lot of markets where you can build parallel institutions, but I'm not convinced it works here. So I'll give you another example that even predates UTAX, which is the Thiel Fellowship. Mm-hmm. So Peter Thiel, you know, sort of billionaire, comes up with a philanthropic idea, which is I'll pay, you know, very talented people who get into very elite schools to drop out or to not go at all. But what was he really doing there? You know, my sort of argument in the book about why that's something that can't really scale much beyond what it already has become is, you know, the Thiel Fellowship is still grafting on to the original language hierarchy of the U.S. News and World Report. It's basically saying someone like, you know, like Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg, they get into Harvard, they drop out. There's this sort of signal that they're borrowing from Harvard, which is that they're good enough to get in, contrarian enough to drop out. And that's what the Thiel Fellowship is sort of institutionalizing.
So they're targeting the same elite schools is what you're saying for the same reasons.
And I would say it's connected to the U.S. News and World Report. Like the strength of the Thiel Fellowship signal is path dependent on that signal already existing.
Right.
And so, you know, if you have an alphabet A, B, C, D, not A is still dependent on A, B, C being decipherable. And so that's what the Thiel Fellowship is doing. I think UTAX is sort of similar, which is because it's such a small and sort of elite place, it's sort of saying, you know, we're not Harvard or we're not Stanford. And they're pulling professors from the same places. It's not clear to me if you can scale that infinitely, if you can make that super big because you're still path dependent on the original system being kind of bad. You know, I think that the much better reform, and I'm all for, you know, new institutions starting and competing, but I think the much better reform is to get everyone still on the same standard, because there is this network effect in first job markets for the vast majority of things. It's a little bit different in venture capital, which is why the Thiel Fellowship works. But, you know, if you want to be a lawyer, you want to be an investment banker, a consultant, or any of these sort of, you know, professional class jobs that have become so common for students that come out of elite universities, you can't really you know, use those pathways to get there.
Is there any pressure to be put on U.S. News and World Report? You suggest some philanthropists coming in and just buying it. Short of that, could there just be, there are other rankings, but they haven't sort of become what U.S. News and World Report has become. What are the solutions there?
Yeah, so rankings is a funny market because it's kind of like languages, or it's kind of like social networks. There's a very strong network effect. So if I say that instead of speaking English, we should speak Esperanto, I need to convince basically everyone, or at least a critical mass of people who speak English, to switch over with me, even though it may be a better language. There may be more informative content per like minute in Esperanto, but it's just not going to happen. And rankings are sort of similar. You have all these sort of copycat rankings or different types of rankings, but there's a de facto standard that U.S. News and World Report is the ranking to look at. And once that sort of language embeds itself, it's sort of like feet and inches. Why do we use that instead of the metric system? Once it's embedded, you're just not going to switch over. You need a critical mass to switch over. And so there may be better measurement systems. There may be better languages. There may be all sorts of better products. But once the network effect is established, it's very hard to switch over. So I think it's difficult to have a rankings competitor. I think it's much better to reform the one we do have.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to ask you the question about your own school, Columbia.
Yeah.
You've not graduated yet, so maybe there's a limited amount you want to actually say before they hand you the diploma. But, I mean, you bought into the system. You're a part of it. Mm-hmm. You went to top schools, so the prestige factor matters to everyone. We all care about it to some degree. But you're there now. Just give us your personal experience. You've been there sort of in the thick of things over the last few years. Just give us your view on the ground of some of the manifestations of some of this cartel problem on the ground, how you're seeing it as a student there. And where do you think Columbia has the best hope of fixing some of the problems that you're seeing? And do you think the federal government's holdback of funds to Columbia and other schools is effective? Just give us your view on the ground.
Sure. So, so my personal experience has been that Columbia is a place where if you want to take the academics seriously, you really can. It's very intellectually stimulating. Your classmates are very smart. My, you know, sort of concern about Columbia, and I think the way the culture is shifting there being a negative, is that there has been this sort of derangement of the campus by the presence of all of these administrators. You know, it's scarcely a day where you don't get an email from some administrator who's trying to get you to do something.
Like what? Give us an example.
I mean, just, you know, some really silly stuff. It's just sort of like, you know, checking boxes on participating in the community in all these sort of fake and pretentious ways. And the administrators, I mean, it's not even like this stuff is mandatory. It's just like there is this feeling that the campus is almost, I don't want to say surveilled, but almost swarming with administrators who are sort of there to make work. And as a student, you know, I think, you know, students sort of are very impressionable, and they take cues from the adults and people in positions of authority on campus. And so, you know, when you have, you know, professors or administrators sending out these signals of there needs to be a certain level of political correctness, or only certain viewpoints will be taken seriously, it does chill speech on campus. And I've certainly seen that in my courses at Columbia. You know,
you experience it more, as a graduate student or as an undergraduate student?
Well, I wasn't there as an undergrad.
Right.
At Georgetown, I think, you know, there was some level of political correctness. I think maybe if I was there now, it would have been worse. But my experience was it was just sort of really getting started. Right. And at this point, it's sort of really embedded. And when I came to Columbia, I mean, it was very much the culture. It was sort of, you know, this soft feeling of self-censorship for a lot of conservative friends of mine. And, you know, it's my politics are sort of left libertarian, but I have conservative friends because I'm interested to hear what they have to say.
Good for
so,
you.
So that I know that, you know, the best responses to what they have to say. And I think that's how we end up with a much healthier politics. But that was not a universal feeling. It was sort of like, you know, if sort of a conservative raised his hand and you know, espoused one of his or her beliefs. And so I think that was a real problem. And again, a lot of this thing, I think, is downstream of sort of the administrative bloat. You know, the other issue I have with Columbia is just it is so expensive that you end up with this demographic of students that are so disconnected from the real world or any real consequences that they end up needing to cosplay, you know, some sort of person involved in the struggle. And so I think, you know, I don't want to, you know, personalize this, but I think there's a lot of students at a place like Columbia that sort of, you know, adopt, you know, other people's struggles or other people's challenges as their own, but in a very performative way. Like, you know, I don't think they're actually doing that much to move the cause particularly forward.
Right. And do you see any change since this new administration, since the measures that have been taken, your former president left, anything different?
I think, you know, they're just shuffling deck chairs on the Titanic at the moment. I am, though, quite hopeful that there can be systemic reform. I think actually, in a bipartisan way, people are beginning to realize that the universities have gotten out of control and are getting more and more deranged. And I think this is actually really important because, especially if you're a Democrat, because the universities are sort of seen as left-leaning institutions. And so if you're a Democrat and your argument is we want more authority or more power to regulate other sectors of the economy, people are going to look at your track record in institutions that you control and dominate. And if, you know, most of the universities, the institutions that are most associated with Democrats are in worse and worse shape, costing more and more, why should anyone trust you with socializing healthcare? Why should anyone trust you in building more housing? You've clearly shown that you can't manage the institutions you already have control of. And I think Democrats need to take this very seriously. If you can reform the universities, I think it sends a signal to the rest of the American citizenry that you are actually serious about solving big problems and getting your own house in order. And so I think you're starting to see that happen. I think there may be bills that pass in Congress to really reform how endowments work, the bloat at the universities, how pricing works. And I think all of those things would be really positive.
Yeah. And just finally, I think I just want to go back to what you were saying about Peter Thiel. I think what's interesting about what he's done, and it's sort of in the same lane as what a lot of other people have done, people like Bill Ackman or Mark Rowan, who have come out and really criticized what's happening on these campuses, is they've made it okay for people to see these schools, to remove some of the prestige facade that's sort of wrapped around a lot of these schools. And I wonder if we could take it a step further and sort of encourage a generation of CEOs and hedge fund managers, and people who are going to be doing the hiring on the other end of these universities, to sort of say out loud, we now no longer view Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Penn as the places from which we are going to recruit only. We are going to broaden our net. And I know a lot of people are already doing this actually in practice, but it's a different thing to say it out loud and to announce that they'd be recruiting from a wider selection of schools to pull some of that prestige addiction away from people and to, you know, I think people, students are going to school to get an education so that they can have a successful life and a successful career. And if they know that they can have those things, going to the top 50 schools instead of the top 20 schools, that would make a difference too.
So I think all of that is correct. I would make two points. The first is on the employer side, I think it's good if we shift away from only taking people from prestigious universities or no university at all seriously. Mm-hmm. And I like that Silicon Valley has sort of a different feel for this and, you know, really encourage people from diverse backgrounds or untraditional backgrounds, maybe you would say. And so I think that's a positive development. I am maybe a little bit more skeptical at how far that's going to go because I think the class interests of middle management are quite strong. So if I'm a Dartmouth guy and that's a big part of my identity and has been for 20 years and that's sort of how I've built my social network and credibility, it's unclear to me if the person making that hiring decision, you know, maybe two layers down or three layers down is going to now just toss out this sort of brand loyalty or loyalty to the system. So I'm skeptical, but I would think it would be an amazing development. The second point I'd make is, you know, everything we've been talking about here is about this like sort of elite substrata of schools, you know, the top 20, even maybe you'd say top 50 schools, and how they collude with U.S. News and World Report and how they're such a problem. I would make the global point that only 2% of American undergraduates go to these schools. But the real problem to me is that those schools sort of set the trends for the rest of the market. So if you're UVA or you're Virginia Tech or you're JMU, you're, you know, sort of ranked by the same rankings that rank Harvard or Stanford or Columbia. And so you internalize the exact same incentives, which is why you've seen all these state schools, these flagship state schools, become more and more exclusive, sort of in lockstep with the really elite private schools. Mm-hmm. And this is really bad because Americans, you know, people from Michigan or people from California or people from Virginia are being pushed out of their own institutions in favor of, you know, sort of out of state or international students who can pay higher prices because these schools need to compete with, you know, the Columbias and Harvards of the world. And I think that's a really negative development. And that's what really affects the other 98% and, you know, systemically drives the debt problem.
Right. All right. There's so much to talk about, but we have to leave it there. But I thank you so much for being here. I think you're the one shiny spot in Columbia's, you know, in Columbia right now. And we're grateful that they at least produce people like you. And that gives us some hope. And everyone should get the book, The College Cartel. Tell us where to find it.
Yeah, so you can find it on Amazon. It's available both as an ebook and in print.
Saj, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.